In my family, twins are pretty normal. My dad is a twin, actually, as are my aunt and uncle, so two sets of twins. My brother has twin daughters. I've had friends throughout my life who turned out to be twinned, and we have several sets of twins at Redeemer. It's always a special blessing, but also a lot of work. Just ask Stephanie or Travis or others who are here, the Gosses, about that. But most of the twins that I've known have a kind of a special kinship with their siblings, the twin, and a connection that actually transcends the surface knowledge or transcends the things that might be visible. For instance, Jim Lewis and Jim Springer were separated at birth when they were put up for adoption in 1940. They met for the first time when they were 39 years of age. And it turns out that the name Jim was actually given to each of them independently by their respective adopted parents. And that's only the beginning. Both men had married twice, first to women named Linda and then to women named Betty. Both had childhood dogs named Toy. Their sons' names were James Allen and James Allen. Both worked as sheriff's deputies, drank the same beer, smoked the same cigarettes, and drove the same Chevrolet. You know, there are actually a number of twins in the Bible, including the ones at the center of our Old Testament narrative today, but these are remembered not for the ways in which they were alike, but the striking difference between them. And the conflict that began in utero and continued for decades, right? You know, this narrative, this story of Jacob and Esau is rich soil for interpretation and development as well, because it's actually, there's not a lot of explanation in the passage, there's not a lot of development in the passage. So it opens itself to all kinds of reading in that's going on. In his book, Leading with a Limp, Dan Allender evaluates the family of Isaac on the basis of their family dysfunction, casting it in psychological categories that our therapists here would recognize. Author Katherine Patterson used the story as background for her iconic young adult novel, Jacob Have I Loved. And poet Jean Steig, who was married for a time to the famous cartoonist William Steig, who actually William invented the character Shrek, and he also wrote that little book, Yellow and Pink. You know that one? Well, anyway, she penned this inspiration from Genesis 25. Esau said, "I'm feeling faint." "Ah," said Jacob, "no, you ain't." "Papa's blessing," Esau cried, "is mine by rights, but I'll have died of hunger first. For pity's sake, my birthright for your lentils, Jake." Your birthright," Jacob murmured. "Sold. Dig in before the stuff gets cold." Now, that doesn't... It doesn't exactly play out that way, right? But it's a story widely known and widely interpreted. Today, I want us to think of it not as an episode on its own, but part of the promise narrative of Abraham's family that we are walking in through really a whole season. Because in this chapter of Genesis, we build on something that's been developing for a long time. And the direction is set for what will be lived out for generations. We step into family dynamics that have a history and they have a future, and we know these dynamics all too well. We see how these things get started and how they continue for generations. We wish we didn't, but we understand the lives of Jacob and Esau because they're not too far from our own and our own families, those that we know. We'd like to point to all the perfect families in the Bible. I can't think of one. Really, there's not. Even Jesus' family had all kinds of issues going on. They tried to put him away because they thought he was crazy. And I think most of us take comfort from that, that the families of the Bible are a lot like the families that we live in. You know, there's a lot about Abraham in Genesis, and there's a lot about Jacob in Genesis, but there's only a small bit about Isaac. Isaac gets sort of a chapter. But he and his wife, Rebecca, who we met last week, also faced the challenge of infertility. Barrenness, the Bible calls it. It's a cruel word, but I think it's apropos here because it's not just about the desire to have children. This is about a need to carry on the promise that God gave to Abraham. It's not just for them, it's for the whole nation. A lot is at stake. The reputation of God is on the line, and we see that both Isaac and Rebekah are people of prayer. They don't seek to work this out the way Abraham did the first time around to kind of manipulate it, Abraham and Sarah. They go to prayer. Each of them pray to seek God and God's will and God's provision. And so when the twins are coming, it's not a natural provision, it is God's provision. It's God's work on display again for us. God is in the story. God remains the main character throughout all the story of Abraham's family. Even before they're born, however, it's clear there will be conflict. Rebecca despairs of life itself due to the pain and discomfort of what she's carrying, and the Lord's word comes to her about this internal conflict and about the destiny of the sons that she carries. What a way to begin, huh? And we see one of the prominent themes of this passage, and that is the theme of conflict. Two nations are in your womb, two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the younger will serve the elder. This is a conflict that will be based on personality and envy and difference of perspective and character. This is very much a human conflict. God declares it, but he's not the author of it. He reveals it to Rebecca, but what we see in the son's behavior is something that's not inevitable. In other words, they don't have to go this way. There's a proclivity in that direction. They have personalities that we see lived out, but choices are made. And the conflict grows out of human action and human decision. I really think the conflict was not part of God's plan for his promise. In fact, it's a direct threat to it. As Jacob takes the birthright from Esau and then later tricks his father into giving him the blessing, the promise of God is every bit at risk as it was when Abraham raised the knife to offer Isaac in sacrifice. And that's because Esau threatens to kill Jacob if it's the last thing he does. And Jacob flees in order to save his life. They do reconcile later if you read on in the story, but it takes 20 years. Now, conflict is inevitable when people get together. But it's how we walk it. How do we deal with conflict? How do we work it through? And I think sometimes we don't understand the importance of dealing with conflict. We'd rather just not have it, and I'm that way too. Let's just step back from it, and maybe it'll go away. But that doesn't usually happen. Isaac and Rebekah, through their favoritism and through their indulgence, actually contribute to the environment of conflict between their sons. At the time that they should be working to bring about peace, they're actually heightening tensions by what they're doing or not doing. As parents, they had what Edwin Friedman would call a failure of nerve, a refusal to stand strong and to do the right thing, calling their sons to proper behavior and relationship. Now, I've seen this in parents and in families, a tendency, especially in, I think, our time and in certain where affluence can be involved, a tendency to let kids raise themselves or to encourage natural traits to grow in directions that will ultimately be harmful. I remember one conversation I had with a parent who had sons who basically said, if there's a fight, I let them fight it out until one wins. That prepares them for life. I made a mental note not to let my kids play over at that house. Bullying does not make people stronger, right? This is true in churches and organizations as well. The conflict needs to be handled effectively at the start, or it will grow and fester and infect the whole system of a place or a people. Conflict like that between Jacob and Esau can wither souls and destroy destinies. The amazing thing for me, and I think for us about this whole story, is that God continues to be at work. Even in the midst of the conflict, God's carrying out his plans. God's bringing about his purposes. I mean, think about the themes that we've seen since we began this journey with Abraham. When God calls Abraham, we see God present with him in the unknown. When Abraham has to send away his older son, Ishmael, we see God in the reality of loss. When Abraham is asked to sacrifice Isaac, we see the miraculous provision of God. Last week, we saw God in the ordinary and the mundane. And this week, we see God working in and through and in spite of a situation that is absolutely broken and full of conflict and dysfunction. So even in our conflicts, God can work and bring about his merciful intentions for us. But it's never what God desires as the best and highest for us. As long as unresolved conflict and separation continues, we're in a place that's less than what God has intended. I don't know if you're aware, we have a document on conflict here at Church of the Redeemer that we borrowed from another church. And it was from a church that had a conflict that emerged that split the church and took many years to work out. Recently, several of the people that were involved in that split and in that conflict spoke to the gathering at the ACNA assembly in Wheaton. And they talked about how they had walked through this, how they had sought to reconcile, how they had to do some hard work with conflict. And someone asked them and said, well, was there anything good that came out of conflict? And they said, yes, there was one thing good that came out of the conflict. And that was Church of the Redeemer. Because this church was planted by one of those people that had to leave the place of conflict. So see, God can do amazing and wonderful things in the midst of conflict, but I don't know that's necessarily how the design was for this church to be started, right? So we can take joy and hope and strength in that. But we see that here as really kind of the first theme of conflict. We also see God choosing. God chooses Jacob, and it's not really clear why that's the case. But it doesn't stop writers and commentators from offering their opinions on the topic, right? There's something mysterious in God siding with Jacob, because we read the story, we know what's coming, we know what's ahead. But he's a guy that's scheming, he's tricky, he's sneaky. We don't necessarily say, Jacob, here's somebody that I'm willing to trust. But God does. And there's no explanation for it. By selling his birthright cheaply, Esau is shown to be someone that despises heritage and can probably not be relied on to cherish the promise of God that was made to his grandfather. So I think we get why Esau was sort of eliminated. But we don't see a lot of that good stuff in Jacob either, at least not at this point, do we? They both have their issues, but the promised line would come through Jacob. Esau also would receive a blessing. He would father a nation, but the promise would not be carried through his line of the family, but through Jacob's. It's simply a reminder to us that God chooses, and God does what he wills. And we're not always able to predict in advance how the will of God will work out. In Romans chapter 9, St. Paul quotes from Moses a word from the Lord that says, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I have compassion. And Paul gives this to us as a reminder that it's not about our effort or goodness, but God's will that determines his work. Now, in that, it's important for us to note that God is not capricious, right? I mean, God is good, and we can trust God, and there's a wideness in the mercy of God, and we see that wideness in his alignment with Jacob. But he chooses Jacob for reasons we can only guess at. In the end, as we discern the will of God for our own lives, for our families, and as we're in a season of discerning specific questions and answers about our church. It's vital that we know what God desires, but maybe not worry so much about why he desires it. Does that make sense? Let's see what God wants to do and not worry so much about why he's making that request of us. We do encounter here a factor about God's choosing that seems to be something we can rely upon in general, and that is God is often in the business of reversing expectations. What do I mean? Well, we see the triumph of the younger over the older, of the one that's in the disadvantaged position over the one that has all the advantages. Now, in the ancient world, it was a given that the firstborn would receive a larger share of the material wealth and also the status as head of the family. It's an understanding known as primogeniture. And we still see it in cultures today around the world. Jacob would pass down to the firstborn, Esau, not only wealth and privilege, but also the promise of blessing and nationhood that was given to Abraham. So the way it worked was if you had 12 sons, you would divide your wealth by 13, and the oldest would get two portions. This was a lot harder when there were only two sons, and even harder still when it was twins, right? And all of those ancient cultures would have said, yes, that's the right way to do this. The eldest son should receive that, should receive the birthright, should receive blessing. But over and over again, we see God align himself with those who do not have access to the cultural advantages or societal places of privilege and power. He chooses the younger over the older. It's not just here. Throughout the scriptures, the younger or the disadvantaged is favored. It's related to God's care of the widow, the orphan, and the stranger, and also the care that we are to express to those who do not have a voice for themselves or are in a place of powerlessness in regard to society. In fact, God chooses the younger son in almost every situation in Genesis. Just go through and see what happens. He chooses David to be king, that no one else would have picked him out of the lineup. He picks Mary to be the mother of Jesus. And of course, the disciples, man, those guys. To a person, they did not have power or position. And as the first great missionary, he chooses a murderer. The last shall be first and the first last. The Bible is an underdog story. And in it, we see not the greatness of the individual characters, but we see the glory of God. And I think that's really the main reason for that. That God chooses those who can't say, I did this. But he chooses those that have to point to him and say, Lord, you did this. This is your work. Because I didn't bring anything to this. This is your doing. Now, I have to say, it's not always clear how we live out this principle in specifics. But it's clearly there in God's character. And something that we must discern about our own attitudes and about how our actions are to follow those attitudes. God doesn't seem to care about the conventions and the expectations of the world system, but seems to reverse them at every opportunity. It reminds me of the Magnificat, where the lowly would be brought up and the high and powerful would be brought down. This isn't a mandate for anarchy or chaos, though. God is a God of order, but his order is very often not our order. That Jacob receives God's blessing should not surprise us very much, actually, when we see the whole pattern of God's interaction with his people throughout time. Why does God choose the way he does? We often cannot know. It's hidden in God's purposes. As one commentator says, this is what the Jacob narrative is about. That the world is filled with practitioners of primogeniture, those who insist on culturally bestowed rights and privileges, and they will have their way at whatever cost if they can. But this is not God's way of the kingdom, which is a reversal of the world's expectations. I remember a number of years ago, I had, and I think I've shared this before here, I had several hours to kill between meetings in Atlanta, and I found myself at the Martin Luther King Museum. And if you ever have that opportunity to do that, you should take the time to go through there. And then across the street is the Ebenezer Baptist Church, where Martin Luther King's father was pastor for a long, long time. And I thought, well, I'll go and walk through the church. And it's open. It's part of the museum, but it's not set up as a museum. It's a church. And the thing that struck me about that place is it's so small. It's not a big church. I mean, it can hold a couple hundred people. But that's it. And as I was leaving, there was an elderly woman sitting by the door, and she said hello to me, and we began to have a conversation, and she said she and her husband had been married in that church 50 years before, and they'd been married by Martin's father. And I said, this must have been an amazing place of activity and energy in the day. She said, well, actually, she goes, this was the small church. She goes, this was the church that didn't have the connections. She goes, this was the church that was sort of the second church. She goes, there was a church up the street. That's where the business owners went. That's where the people who were connected went. She goes, the best families, the top families, they went to that other church. And that made me think about how God chooses sometimes. We should not despise humble beginnings. It's why the church throughout its life has built hospitals and cared for lepers. It's why the church has supported refugees. It's why when God wanted to renew the Anglican church around the world, he started with the most humble and the least powerful, one that had been decimated by genocide, that little East African country of Rwanda. The last place you would go to say, hey, we're gonna do a movement that's gonna shape the next 100 years or so of the church. And yet that's where God began. In our passage today, the Jacob story has begun, and we're going to be following it for several weeks. And Jacob will become Israel, and Israel will become a people. And that people will come to include us as well. Jacob's story is our story of humble choosing and glorious provision. Amen.